Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Hallett. Well, after a week off, we're back with our WFPL News Roundtable. Most of it, joining us are Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, and Philip M. Bailey. Welcome, everyone.
Hey, Rick. Hello.
Gabe Bullard has an excused absence this week. He'll be back on the program next week. Should have the full family back together after several weeks apart next Friday. As always, we welcome your participation, 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255, or toll-free, 1-877-814-TALK. That's 1-877-814-8255. You can also email us at news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet at WFPLnews, or comment through our Facebook account, or ask a question through our Facebook account. And we welcome your input on the topics we're discussing today. We're going to start with Philip M. Bailey. And Governor Beshear yesterday, Philip, says he will ask the legislature to once again consider expanded gambling.
On the heels of that 25-point victory that Governor Beshear had against State Senate President David Williams, many wondered what specifically, what mandate he would say that he had, considering that his campaign wasn't based upon really looking to the future, more so about what he had done over the past 4 years. And it's clear from his speech at the Kentucky Farm Bureau that Governor Beshear is saying that one of the things that the vote clearly says is that there's a message between voters sending a message to lawmakers that they need to work with him, and also that there needs to be more cooperation and teamwork in Frankfort. One of the top issues that Governor Beshear says he will bring up will be expanded gaming, which was the centerpiece of his campaign back in 2007. So what we'll see, I think, is that Governor Beshear will use that 25-point margin of victory as political capital. It certainly has given him a newfound, I think, ability to sort of trump Senator Williams in that aspect. Say he mentioned during our interview yesterday that one of the chief differences between him and Senator Williams was the issue of gaming. People had a chance and a choice between the two of them, and they overwhelmingly picked the governor.
Has he been specific on what type of gaming you're going to allow, or where it would be allowed, such as horse tracks only or whatnot?
Governor Beshear was asked all those questions and then some, and he basically says he's open to any of those ideas, mm-hmm. whether it's standalone casinos in cities, whether it's gaming at racetracks or other facilities. He's also open to the idea of it being on a constitutional amendment on the ballot next November. That has been a bit of minutiae, I think, for obvious reasons for general observers. But I think what we see now is you have a situation where there's a choice between that or just state lawmakers passing it. Republicans have obviously said in some aspects that let's put it on the constitutional amendment on the ballot in November. House Democrats have had an issue with that politically, saying that that could result in a backlash against them and electorally. The governor says he's open to any of those ideas, and that he I know House Speaker Greg Stumbo said that he's not really in favor of the idea of a constitutional amendment, but the governor says, listen, it'll be 2012. The main issue will be the presidential race. If there's any type of political backlash, it won't be as a result of gaming. So I think what we'll see going into in January is the governor will have, I think, a bigger stick to carry as a result of those that margin of victory against Senator Williams. But the devil's in the details as far as whether it should be passed through existing state law, which Republicans seem to oppose, and whether it be through a constitutional amendment, which House Democrats appear to be opposed to as well.
All right. Thank you, Philip. We're going to go to Erica Peterson now, our WFPL environment reporter. And we're going to stay with the Beshear administration because the administration fired the Commissioner of Natural Resources earlier this week. First of all, Erica, what does the commissioner do?
Well, the Energy and Environment Cabinet is set up where there is the secretary, which is Dr. Len Peters, and then there are a bunch of commissioners under him. And in natural resources, the commissioner oversees kind of a wide variety of programs. There are a couple of coal-related programs, like mine reclamation and enforcement. Mine safety is under him, forestry, oil and gas, and a couple of other things. So it's pretty much a mixed bag.
This particular commissioner is Carl Campbell. And any reason why he's been let go?
Well, the Beshear administration didn't give any reasons, and they don't have to. He's a political appointee, and in his letter of dismissal, it pretty much said, we don't have a reason to fire you, but your services are no longer needed here, which is, I guess I've been told, is pretty standard for these dismissal letters. There are a couple of speculations, though. Carl Campbell was known as he was kind of he had a lot of experience in mine reclamation enforcement. He had spent 25 years in that department before he was promoted to commissioner, and he was praised by pretty much everyone after he was fired. Environmental groups said they had always felt like he'd given them a fair shake in dealing with these issues. And the coal industry as well had said they found that his office was always open. He was willing to listen to them. But Tom Fitzgerald of the Kentucky Resources Council said one thing that Carl Campbell was pushing for was to get mine operators to put more money into bonds. And when mine operators do surface mining, they have to take out these bonds, which basically puts a bunch of money aside in case something happens, the company goes bankrupt, or they just leave. It's money to reclaim the land like it has to be under law. And a lot of studies have shown that the money they put aside in Kentucky just isn't sufficient to reclaim the land if that happens. So he was pushing to raise the amount of money they have to put into bonds, which did not win him any friends in the industry.
So what effect, obviously going to be a new commissioner coming in, what effect could a new commissioner have on the department's programs?
Well, it depends. The new commissioner obviously will have to follow the law. He or she will be, will have to follow the surface mining law, the federal, state, all those things. But there is a significant amount of wiggle room. There's a lot of some of these laws require some interpretation, and in terms of which direction new policies go in, the person's political and personal beliefs could really have a big impact. And earlier this week, the Kentucky Energy Environment Cabinet said they wanted to have somebody new on board by the end of the week. Obviously, I guess they had somebody in mind. Mm-hmm. But we are at the end of the week and haven't seen that yet. So hopefully sometime soon.
All right. Thanks, Erica. I'm going to break away for just a moment because we have some questions coming in about what's going on at the Clark Memorial Bridge at this time. The Second Street Bridge is closed, and we understand that there's been a head-on accident on the bridge, and that has resulted in its closure. And of course, authorities will get that cleared up as soon as they can. Again, a head-on accident on the Clark Memorial Bridge early this afternoon, and responders are on the scene and working to clear that accident as soon as possible. Now back to State of the News, and we're going to go to Devin Katayama now. And Devin, you've been following the twisted trail of the fireworks ordinance.
I've been trying to follow it, yeah.
So where do we stand now? These bottle rockets I have in my hand, should I turn them in?
You might want to just keep hold of those for right now and just put them in your closet. There has been another ordinance that would pass the Public Safety Committee. It will go in front of the full council next week. This was something that they knew was in the Public Safety Committee. They weren't sure if they were going to get around to it before the end of the year, in which case a new Public Safety Committee would be reappointed or redistributed, and then they would have to, go through that process again. But this will be in front of the full council, and they'll basically be deciding on whether to allow, again, larger fireworks, Roman candles, those bottle rockets that you have in your closet there, Rick. They're going to possibly allow those once again, which means that within 5 days of 4th of July and December 31st, you will be able to light them off. Now, according to the ordinance that's been proposed, they can sell them year-round, but people can only light them off during those 5 days before 4th of July and December 31st.
So, and this all stems from a state law that was passed earlier, right?
That
allowed
state,
the communities to sell
right,
these things.
Right, basically it left it up to the local municipalities, and earlier this year we allowed the sales of these larger fireworks, or the allowed people to set them off as well. And there were some discussions in the last meeting last week when this was approved by the full council. There was a lot of debate, actually. I think it was about an hour. I listened to most of it. Some people were concerned that there were not more injuries this past 4th of July, but the severity of the injuries had increased. Now, I talked to Jerry Miller, who's one of the supporters of the lifting the ban, and he said he also spoke with nurses and people at the hospitals, and he said that information is incorrect. So it's kind of hard to get the information accurate for exactly what kind of injuries we're talking about and how severe they might have been. But the ordinance that bans the big fireworks has been supported heavily by the fire departments.
I see. Now, Mayor Fisher has signed all these ordinances as they're passed, and so what's he going to do next?
Well, I mean, I'm assuming that he'll continue signing what Metro Council puts forth. I talked to Chris Pointer. Chris Pointer said that he'll continue considering what the council approves. I take that to mean that, he'll continue signing these ordinances. And so he has signed contradicting ordinances, and he has said in the past that he's going to leave this decision up to Metro Council.
All right. Thanks, Devin. Philip M. Bailey, back to you. We'll stay with Metro government. There was a critical report that came out last week when we were off from the University of Louisville criticizing the city-county merger.
Yeah, what we see in the report that was requested by State Representative Daryl Owens, who was a part of Mayor Fisher's Merger 2.0 Task Force. The study was conducted by Professor Hank Savage, who has been a previous critic of and done some data reports and information on merger before. Basically, what it found was that key promises of the city-county merger, the consolidation of those two, failed in some key aspects, particularly on job growth, more efficient government services. If people remember back in 2000 when the merger campaign first started, proponents of the consolidation made a lot of those promises. Essentially, what Professor Savage found was that those things have not come to fruition, that we have not gained a better economic foothold or economic development foothold as a result of merger. And one thing he was certainly critical of was from, you know, things from public safety to road maintenance in the report. When I interviewed Professor Savage, he talked about how Jefferson County from edge to edge is about 35 miles, which is the same distance between Baltimore and Washington, D.C. And the idea that you could have one government for all those services, for all those functions that would run efficiently, he says is quite impossible. And his recommendations aren't to undo merger. I know there are some critics out there who are already calling for people to undo or untie the binds. He says the answer is decentralization of certain services. We need a bottom-up approach when it comes to some of the way we run metro government here. There have been obviously different responses from people in the Metro Council. Councilman Tom Owen, who was initially a merger critic, says that the consolidation has been a total failure, but that there's a lack of accurate accounting of the cost of certain services, particularly in the urban service district, which is been a problem, particularly for council Republicans, for a number of years. The fact that we don't know, and we are one of the few merged governments that doesn't know how much we're actually paying for services within the old city limits. The only other merged government that's like that is Athens, Georgia, which is very, very small compared to Louisville. So that's been an issue for a number of years, and that's one of the things that Professor Savage says that has to be corrected. We have to know what we're actually paying for.
All right. Thanks, Philip. Just a couple of more topics to get on. Just got a minute or so to get through these. Erica, quickly, Mayor Fisher has narrowed the field for Louisville's new Director of Sustainability. Where do we stand now?
Well, we've down to three candidates. This is something that Metro Government has been working on since, I think, July, the funding became available. And the job description is still pretty open. They pretty much want the new Director of Sustainability to do everything in this one-person office. But they say that they should get have their finalist sometime this month.
All right. And Devin, finally, the Greater Clark County School Board is offering Superintendent Stephen Dashner the chance to remain at his current position, but with lower pay. Where does that stand?
There's a few ways Dashner can remain with the district. One is to remain as superintendent, and they're thinking about a salary of around $150,000 to $175,000. Right now, he's being paid $225,000. And by the way, they're also trying to close this $4 million budget gap. Mm-hmm. Another option is for him to move roles, maybe like a chief academic officer, something that has to do with curriculum is what they really want to keep him in, because that's what he's been successful at. The other option is basically just to not renew his contract, and they are in negotiations. They should be making the decision by December 20th. That's when the last scheduled public kind of meeting is going to be taking place.
And there's going to be a rally next week supporting him?
Yeah, some former board members who were on the board when they hired him, Robbie Valentine, has put together a rally at 6 o'clock at, I believe it's Keys or Keys or something like that over in Indiana. He's thinking that the turnout is going to be pretty good. He told me that the superintendent was going to be there. Mayor Galligan was going to be there. So I'm assuming it's going to have some kind of cachet when it comes down to it.
All right. Our news team is going to be returning with us in just a moment. We're going to take our first break. When we come back, the University of Louisville announced the recipients of the 2012 Grawemeyer Awards, and we will hear from some of those recipients. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, this week, the University of Louisville announced the recipients of the 2012 Grawemeyer Awards for Music, Psychology, Ideas Improving World Order, and Religion. The awards include a $100,000 cash prize. There's no award for education at this time. The 2012 Grawemeyer for Music will go to Finnish composer Esa-Pekka Salonen for his 2009 piece Violin Concerto. Salonen is the principal conductor and artistic advisor for the Philharmonia Orchestra of London. He wrote the piece at his previous post as music director for the Los Angeles Philharmonic, a position he held for 17 years. Salonen says the composition came easy for him, and it required few revisions after he finished it. WFPL's Gabe Bullard talked to Salonen about the work.
The piece starts with what Salonen calls a flickering violin. For the next 30 minutes, it runs through flourishes, somber soundscapes, a dance, more modern sound, and it ends with a chord that Salonen says is intentionally not reflective of any of the previous music.
When I thought about my life, it kind of became clear that there was a symbolic meaning in this, because I was just finishing my 17-year tenure with the LA Philharmonic, and I was stepping down and starting the next chapter in my life.
Salonen says he hasn't yet decided what he'll do with the $100,000 prize, but he may use it to encourage young people to compose music. Gabe Bullard, WFPL News.
And that's Gabe's report on the 2012 Grawemeyer recipient for music, Esa-Pekka Salonen of Finland. Now we're going to turn it over to Erica Peterson, who spoke to the recipient for the Grawemeyer for Ideas Improving World Order. Erica.
Thanks, Rick. That Grawemeyer was won by Severine Ataser, and she is a political science professor at Barnard College and Columbia University in New York. She wrote a book called The Trouble with the Congo, Local Violence and the Failure of International Peace Building. And in this book, she examines all the international resources that went towards peacekeeping in the Congo and how those efforts failed. I talked with her about how the Congo provides a lens to examine systematic problems with the international peacekeeping culture.
The core of my book is trying to understand why violence continues despite the peace process and despite the massive international efforts at trying to build peace. The first part of the answer is that violence continued mostly because of the persistence of local conflict, which remain unaddressed. And when I say local, I really mean at the level of the individual, the family, the clan, the village, the municipality, the district, sometimes the ethnic group. And the second part of my answer is trying to understand why international peace builders have only rarely targeted local conflict and why they have let this local violence continue and escalate and jeopardize everything that was achieved throughout the years. And what I found is that there is an international peace building culture that is shared by members of the United Nations, of various foreign ministries, of many NGOs, and that this peace-building culture precludes international action at the local level.
Ataser goes on to talk about that international peacekeeping culture, which she says is one that dismisses local conflicts as negligible. She says oftentimes outsiders will come into countries like the Congo and look towards things like elections to solve all their problems. But at least some attention should be paid to resolving local conflicts that end up exacerbating violence at the national level. And she also added that the lessons she gathered from peacekeeping in the Congo apply to many other war-torn countries, including Afghanistan and Iraq.
All right. Thank you, Erica. And Devin Katayama, you spoke with the Grawemeyer recipient for psychology.
Yeah, actually two recipients, Leslie Ungerleiter and Mortimer Mishkin. They actually began working together in the 1970s. And in 1982 is when they published their first report. And it had to do with studying the brain's reaction to different visual exercises in primates, which has actually been kind of turned over to humans at this point. But their reports kind of focused on circuits in the human brain and helped construct this roadmap for how information is processed. What they kind of found is these two different pathways that they didn't know were there of electrical circuits that kind of connect and operate and helps us understand what we see and how we remember what we see. Studying the vision can kind of lead to this framework of how everything else in the body kind of works.
So vision is one of the sensory modalities, a major one, that starts it all, but it's just the beginning of all of those things that go on in the brain. And what we are trying to do is put together the information about the circuits that underlie the use of the visual information for cognition, that is a thought process, for learning how to respond to different stimuli, for motivation and emotional responses, for social responses, and so on.
We know that the pathway is important not only for recognizing objects and recognizing what you see, but also for the long-term storage of those object representations.
That's what we are beginning to understand. The wiring diagram what its source is, what its various targets are, and thereby understanding what goes on in the brain and how we are what we are.
Now, what you heard there was basically they're scraping the surface of the brain. Obviously, the brain is, as Mishkin said, one of the most complex things in our body, and it's just incredible how much we don't know about it. I asked him if he thought we would ever be able to dissect it, and he said there's no way because it's always changing. It's a plastic thing. It's constantly adapting to different things, and my experiences differ from yours. So to try to figure out, they're basically just trying to figure out the roadmap for the brain, and everything that happens within that is kind of our own experiences.
All right. Before we go to our last recipient, I do want to give an update on the Clark Memorial Bridge situation. The Clark is closed this afternoon after a report of a collision with injuries near the Kentucky-Indiana state line, and police and other emergency crews were called about 12:25 this afternoon, a report of a head-on collision between a pickup and a car. Obviously, the bridge is closed because of this accident, and they're trying to get it reopened as soon as possible. Again, the Clark Memorial Bridge closed due to a traffic accident, and the police and officials are on the scene. Now, a University of Pennsylvania professor of history and American social thought is the recipient of the 2012 Graumeier Award in Religion. It's presented jointly by U of L and the Louisville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. Dr. Barbara Savage is being honored for her book, Your Spirits Walk Beside Us, The Politics of Black Religion, and I spoke with her this week. Well, in the book, you explore the relationship between black religion, as you call it in the title, and political activism, including the civil rights movement. There's been an assumption among many that the church and politics have always been kind of intertwined, but you reveal that that hasn't been the case.
The church and politics have been thought to be intertwined, but in fact, what one sees if you look back in history is that there's always been a great deal of debate and controversy and argument both within the church and outside of black churches about what the public responsibility or the political role of churches ought to be, and a great deal of diversity in terms of the way that people answer that question.
And another long-held assumption, I think, is the idea of the black church, but there are many churches with different political and intellectual leanings, aren't there?
There are, and not to mention denominational differences and theological differences. I'd say regional differences, you know, as well. And all of these, in turn, then affect the way that African American churches interpret or think about a variety of political issues.
Who are some of the historical figures that you study in the book?
Well, I start the book by looking at those black scholars who pioneered the field of African-American religious history. And they include popular figures like W.B. Du Bois and Carter G. Woodson and Benjamin Mays, who were people who also had very prominent public positions in addition to being PhD-trained scholars. And I then bring the story forward and try to look at the ideas about black churches and politics that were held by people who did not have access to formal education in that way, but who were very, very involved in some of these same questions. And that then gets me to folks like Mary McLeod Bethune, a very well-known, perhaps the most well-known black public figure, female figure of the early part of the 20th century, Nanny Helen Burroughs, and then moving into the civil rights movement, much more prominent names, John Lewis, and Stokely Carmichael and others, who also had very strong views on the relationship between African-American religion and politics. And I think finally, at the end of the book, seeing how this played out actually in the 2008 election with the controversies that erupted between then-Senator Obama and Reverend Jeremiah Wright, his pastor.
What was your reaction upon learning that you will be receiving the Graumeier Prize?
Well, I was very surprised and very pleased. It is, to me, I felt that it was a recognition of the power of the history that I had been trying to preserve and to write about in the book. And so I think my first thought was a sort of a vindication of the importance of the lives and the work of the people that I had studied and written about. And so in some way, I feel the prize honors them, and honors their work and their lives and their thoughtfulness on these issues.
Dr. Barbara Savage is professor of history and American social thought at the University of Pennsylvania and the recipient of the Grawemeyer Prize for Religion for Your Spirits Walk Beside Us, The Politics of Black Religion. Dr. Savage, congratulations and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And you can hear an extended version of our interview with Dr. Barbara Savage and all of our Grawemeyer interviews at our website, WFPL.org. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. And before we move on, I do want to pass along an update on the Clark Memorial Bridge situation. The Clark Bridge is closed at this time after a head-on collision between a truck and a car earlier this afternoon. Police, other officials are on the scene trying to get the scene cleared as quickly as possible. Again, the Clark Memorial Bridge closed this hour because of a head-on collision. Throughout November, we presented a series of interviews with immigrant entrepreneurs in Louisville. On Tuesday, we concluded with a public forum in our performance studio. We'll hear an excerpt of that forum and talk with WFPL's Philip Bailey about his work on that series and what we learned. We'll be hearing the voices of Cedric Francois, a Belgian native who founded Apellis Pharmaceuticals, Eddie Momry, food and beverage management professor at Sullivan University and former owner of the Bistro Road to Morocco, Papa Gay, owner of African Millennium Market, and Kadia Tujala, owner of Mashallah West African restaurant. Here they talk about how they are perceived by Americans born in the U.S. and whether they have faced discrimination.
For most Europeans to come to the United States is not a big cultural shock. I mean, when you have your accent and you look European, it's, people are interested and intrigued and all these things. I personally never felt discriminated against in this country. And that's definitely not the case everywhere, you know. There's other places where you do feel kind of a barrier that is not present here, so.
Eddie?
No, never been discriminated against, you know, because of my accent or my origins and such. But it's just, it was funny because, you know, either people consider you a prince when you say I'm from Morocco or another Mexican or another Indian. So, because Morocco, Monaco, they put you completely, totally different part of the map. Some others make me feel great when they say, oh, you know, Morocco, Casablanca, the movie Casablanca and such, or Road to Morocco, Bob Hope and all that. Yeah. So those were great, great shots.
Papa, I guess continue on that line of questioning. I mean, the fact that you talked about the language barrier, but when people first see you, when they first meet you, their impression and how that's affected, I guess, your personal life and not necessarily discrimination, but how that's affected your personal life and business life.
It affected me more in the beginning. I think the longer you stay, you find a better way to respond to people's expectation. At first, Cedric touched on it a little bit, and I think we talked about it during our interview, is that it's different when you're from Western Europe and then when you're from Africa. It's different. The perception is definitely different. Like Cedric, if he didn't open his mouth, I wouldn't know he's not American.
I'm Eurotrash.
You see? So Cedric can blend in easier than I can. So for me, people are waiting for me to open my mouth and to kind of categorize me where I'm from. And then the accent comes in. Now I say Louisville instead of Louisville. I've got a French. I should be saying Louisville because I have a French background. But instead of being frustrated, I get to a point where it's more like, okay, it's an opportunity to educate.
Kariatu, we talked about this as well, the perception people have depending on where you're from. And obviously this panel shows the diversity here. Does that change depending on who you talk to as well? Meaning that if you're talking to maybe a local African-American, that may be different than if you're talking to a local white Louisvillian. Does that change it at all?
Yeah, I mean, it just depends on people that you talk to sometimes. It's really hard. You know, we talked about it before, when you're from Africa and when you're from Europe, as Papa said. It's easy for people from Europe to blend in, but it's hard for us. I mean, sometimes she cannot blame people according to their action. Somebody that never go nowhere, you cannot expect them to know a lot about your culture. For example, when they come, some Black American comes to my restaurant, they'll be like, oh, African food? It's African food. I know. You know, we talked about that off the radio, right? Oh, you want to try? No, I don't think I would like it. But I will try and make them try. And trust me, they will come every day.
And Philip Bailey, you conducted all these interviews and you hosted the forum that we had this week. Quite an enlightening experience.
Yeah, certainly. I think that what you see when you talk about immigrant entrepreneurs, you could never be diverse enough. I mean, our panel discussion included, a diverse continent such as Africa, which has, 56 different countries. So any country from there, I think, is diverse by itself. And then you have, someone from parts of Europe. So I think what we saw in that conversation was that, when immigrants come to the United States and they start a business, there are many different struggles that they face, both personally and in their business life, whether it's the culture that they have to overcome. I think for Cedric, who's from Belgium, the issue for him, because he's coming from a different profession altogether with a medical situation, having a pharmaceutical company. But as he said, I mean, he looks American, quote unquote, whatever that means, meaning basically he's white and he's allowed to have a certain level of privilege as a result of people don't know that he's a foreigner until he speaks. Whereas in Papa and Kadiatu and even Eddie to a degree, because they're people of color, there is an easier assumption that, well, are you from here? Where are you from? The whole idea of the other. So it still gets it, even in, I guess, in Obama's America, where we have this issue of diversity, and we talk about how diverse America is, there still is that dividing line of who looks American, who doesn't. But I think overall, all of them say that Louisville certainly is a welcoming city, and that culturally and socially speaking, the immigrant population here is growing. There is a question, however, is that translating? Is there a parallel to that in the business world? Obviously, we don't really see that too much in the political world either. In a city like New York, you can really get into the meat of Moroccan culture or Senegalese culture or Gambian culture or Belgian culture. Sometimes here it's just the surface, and diversity for diversity's sake doesn't necessarily get to the meat of the issue. But I think that it was certainly an enlightening conversation that many people appreciated and I certainly found worthwhile.
All right, Philip, talking about our immigrant entrepreneur series that we had here on WFPL that culminated in a public forum. Before we let you go, Philip, we've been watching the Clark Memorial Bridge situation. An accident early this afternoon has shut down the Clark Memorial Bridge. It looks like maybe about 3 o'clock or so before it's reopened.
Yeah, it seems that at this point, the nasty, real nasty head-on collision on the Clark Memorial Bridge, otherwise known as the Second Street Bridge, emergency crews from both Jeffersontown and from Louisville are saying the bridge could be closed down in both lanes. It's closed down now in both lanes. In both directions, it could be closed for several hours. 3 p.m. is the earliest in which the emergency crews are saying that they could reopen the bridge. At this point, the problem with that is obviously, as everyone in this region now knows, the Sherman-Minton Bridge has been closed since September. We only have one bridge now at our disposal. That's the Kennedy, otherwise known as I-65.
Down to one, but hope it back up to 2 by about 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Yeah, it's a Friday.
All right. Thank you, Philip Bailey. When we come back, we're going to take a break now. When we come back, we'll talk with writer James Higdon about the Cornbread Mafia Marijuana Syndicate. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Last month, President Barack Obama granted a pardon to Les Berry Jr. of Loretto, Kentucky, who'd served 3 years in prison for his role in what federal officials call one of the country's largest domestic marijuana syndicates, dubbed the Cornbread Mafia. Joining us to talk about the pardon and the Cornbread Mafia is James Higdon, who is a freelance journalist, former web producer for the New York Times, editor at the PBS Frontline's Tehran Bureau, has been working on a book that's coming out next year called The Cornbread Mafia. And James joins us by phone. James, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be with you.
Where are you today?
I'm in Lebanon.
Oh, okay. Well, let's start with some background. What is the Cornbread Mafia, and who came up with the name?
This is a controversial topic, or controversial question. The first time the name was mentioned publicly was in a press conference in 1989, and it was mentioned by federal prosecutors when they revealed the scope of the Cornbread Mafia to the press corps. And then the news wires and the local news affiliates began using that name to describe marijuana growers in the area, and it just kind of stuck. Now, prosecutors say in internal documents released by the Freedom of Information Act to me that are in the book say that members of that organization called themselves that, and then the prosecutors passed on that information to the press. But still, people around here disavow that name but it's kind of stuck.
I see. Now, this was a multi-state, marijuana growing and distribution operation?
Yeah, that's accurate, yeah.
But it had roots in where you are, in the Marion County and Central Kentucky area.
That's correct. So, well, I mean, you know, the way to look at it is an evolving game of cat and mouse. When the Kentucky State Police started flying helicopters over Marion County in 1980, the growers began to diversify their land holdings and started moving places where they were less likely to encounter aerial surveillance, and that's why you start getting these multi-state, out-of-state farm systems set up.
How much marijuana are we talking about? Did it move?
Between 85 and 89, police in 10 states busted 30 farms with 200 tons.
Wow. This is a huge, and this is domestic marijuana. This is not something imported from elsewhere.
Well, there was a smuggling aspect to the cornbread system as well, but not anything officially in terms of what the prosecutors uncovered. So, strictly speaking, it is the largest domestic marijuana syndicate in American history, and the caveat is domestic, as in non-smuggled.
Now, who was the leader of this operation?
It wasn't. The word mafia here is a misnomer because it's not organized.
No.
In a pyramid like fashion, like of the Cosa Nostra would be. There's not a godfather and lieutenants and soldiers like that. It's much more organic. A crew would go out. A half a dozen guys, and they grow a big field, and they make a bunch of money, and then the next season, their cousins and nephews would go out and do it.
So
there was this sort of marketplace, where people kind of knew what was going on. Sometimes crews would compete with one another on price, and then other times crews would cooperate with each other to help fill orders. At that press conference in 89, they named three members as people that they believe, the prosecutors believe, to be the ringleaders or the kingpins of that organization, but they were never prosecuted as such.
Now, the name Johnny Boone comes up. I guess he was a major figure, right?
That's correct, yeah.
And he is, was he ever arrested?
Oh, yeah.
But I saw on a newspaper account or an Associated Press account that he kind of went back into the business.
Well, that's accurate. He's currently a federal fugitive. He's running from the federal three strikes law. He's facing his third federal strike, which means mandatory life in prison without parole. His first strike was in 1982. He had just come back, or he had met an airplane at Bowman Field in Louisville, having come back from Belize with 550 pounds of pot. And that was his first federal strike, and then he was busted again in 1987 in Minnesota, and that was the farm on which Les Berry was a worker.
I see. It brings us back to Les Berry, who I mentioned in the introduction.
Correct.
And so he gets a pardon from President Obama last month. How did this come about?
It was news to me when it happened, and I think everybody was pretty surprised. And in retrospect, it's really surprising. I went out to talk to Mr. Berry. He's not interested in talking to the press, or letting anyone see his pardon application, which is a pretty lengthy ordeal. It's a 23-page application, and there's lots of documents and paperwork and three character references and all these other sorts of things that go into it. So he had to have worked on it for a considerable amount of time, and it seemed as if it was in the works for years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure he thought that when Johnny Boone became a fugitive again in 2008, that his chances were sunk. However, it happened, and no one in the government, the pardon attorney's office, the Department of Justice, no one talks about the reasons for granting these sorts of things. So it's just sort of, done.
And Berry was not a major player in the operation, but he was arrested at some point in the 80s.
He was, he'd only been on that farm for 3 weeks. He was there because he needed a job. He had kids. The unemployment rate in Marion County at the time was approaching 20%. And so he needed a job. Someone told him, here's a job. He went and did it. And then, 3 weeks later, he gets busted, or they get busted. So, he was a good candidate for a pardon in that He was a former U.S. Marine, and he, you know, really did, really behaved really well in a bad situation. He and six other guys got out of that farm and managed to get away. They were eventually caught in Wisconsin driving a 1972 blue Chevy Impala that they had purchased using the run money that they had on them. They pulled that money together. I think each of them had $500, so that's $3,500. You know, they purchased their own getaway car. So, I mean, you know, I don't know if that fit into the qualifications for what the pardon attorney's office was looking for, but, you know, when it happened, you know, it happened the week of Thanksgiving, so no one was really paying attention.
Right.
So, and someone asked me about it, and I looked at the names, and I was like, well, I know that name. That was the first I'd heard about it.
You said that this was called a mafia, but it really wasn't a mafia in the traditional sense of the word. Now, you've been working on this book. Was there a code of silence like we would see in a mafia?
Oh, yes, a strong one.
Hard to get people to talk?
It was very difficult to get people to talk and remains difficult to get people to talk. And I had, more failure than success in that regard.
You probably grew up around Marion County, didn't you?
I did, yes.
I grew up in Nelson County and started my career there. So in that part of the state always... I mean, there's mostly law-abiding citizens there, good people, but it was always looked upon as a rather colorful area over the years, I guess dating back to Prohibition, you know, some interesting activities going on.
You know, interesting is one way of putting it. you know, outlaw is another way of putting it. Prohibition, you know, shuttered 9 distilleries in Marion County. It wrecked our economy. I mean, we had hundreds of Catholic families working these distilleries with no other way to make a living. So... they developed this natural justification for committing criminal acts while still remaining sort of within the moral fold of the community, that one could break man's law without breaking God's law.
Mm-hmm.
And that concept, you know, sort of carried through the generations. And then when kids started coming back from Vietnam with the knowledge of marijuana, it was just a natural fit.
Right. And your book is still scheduled for publication in April?
It is scheduled for publication on April 20 of 2012. And it's currently available for pre-order on Amazon.
Okay, James Higdon, a writer whose new book, The Cornbread Mafia, will come out in April. James, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to make a transition now from the Cornbread Mafia to Eric Crawford of the Courier-Journal, who's here to talk about some sports stuff coming up this weekend. Hi, Eric.
There's no smooth way to do that,
no,
is there?
No, there's not really. I did the best I could. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with UofL football. The Cardinals, a young team being rebuilt by second-year coach Charlie Strong, got off to that dismal 2-4 start, and then they win 5 of 6 to capture a share of the Big East title and possibly a bid to an upper echelon bowl game. How did Strong and his staff get this thing turned around?
Well, I think, you know, as you look at it, they just have so many young players. When we went back and looked at the stats at the end of the season, three-quarters of their production in the month of November and on offense and defense was really from freshmen and sophomores. So I think they did a good job of bringing those young players along and sticking it, you know, hanging in there with them. And there is some young talent. They've recruited well in two classes. So they've got some talent, some promise.
We usually attend the press conferences he has on Monday. I remember after the Marshall game, being so angry and saying, we're not very good, you know, this is unacceptable. And I really thought, boy, this is not going to be a very good season. And they really managed to turn it around. Now, someone the other day, this past Monday, asked Strong if this was a BCS team. And he kind of let out a big laugh and said, no, but we're going to, you know, play the best we can if we make it to the Orange Bowl, which they could if there's a Cincinnati loss tomorrow. He also quoted you when you said in a column that if you finish last in your medical school class, they still call you a doctor.
That's one of the oldest ones in the book. Yeah. I can't even claim it originally, but it's just remarkable, though, that we're having this discussion that Louisville still is in play for the Orange Bowl. They lost to Florida International and Marshall. Now, a lot of it is, you know, the quirks of the system, and the Big East Conference just is not very good, so anybody can win it, and yet... you're right. If Cincinnati loses tomorrow, then Louisville's going to the Orange. Or Cincinnati loses tomorrow, then Louisville is going to the Orange Bowl, and that's just almost unbelievable.
Cincinnati will play Connecticut tomorrow at home at Cincinnati, yeah. And I guess they haven't played yet this year, but they played last year.
Cincinnati's a 9 or 10 point favorite, mm-hmm. and is generally expected to win this game. But the interesting thing is, if Cincinnati wins, then West Virginia will go. So Cincinnati can't, you know, really get there either way. So if Cincinnati wins, it's actually going to benefit a team that is not only leaving the league, but has a lawsuit against the league. So I don't know. They're going to play hard. They're going to do everything they can to win, but it's probably not best for the league for West Virginia to go, I don't think.
This is crazy. So if Cincinnati wins, that would take Louisville out of the Orange Bowl picture, but then there's these other possibilities.
They would go to a much, much lower level bowl, one of the lower level Big East bowls, because West Virginia, they're going to take, I don't know, West Virginia will take if they take the BCS slot, then Louisville will get one of the next two. Mm-hmm. The big thing with the bowl is that it gets you a little bit of visibility. It worked great last year for Louisville because they had a bowl in Florida. Even though it's a low-level bowl, if I were them, I don't think I'd mind going back to that same one. It lets your coaches be in the state and recruit.
Now, with Charlie Strong's success this year, inevitably there's talk of other job openings, and that seems like the case now, at least some rumors flying around that some other schools want him.
Well, he's going to be in the mix for a lot, and in fact, a lot of the schools that could be in play are schools that have taken a pass on him sometime in the last 15 years. The one thing you saw was Louisville come through with a contract extension earlier this year that raised his salary to $2.3 million. I think he's in for another $100,000 in bonuses and even more if they make this Orange Bowl.
Yeah.
That puts him at a level of a lot of other schools out there. Texas A&M's job just came open, and he's actually making more than the Texas A&M coach was making. So his salary is competitive with all these other jobs. The question is, do you want that big-time football label? Do you want to have that guaranteed 60, 70,000 people in seats at every game? And that's just something, the call he'll have to make for himself.
Now, let's switch over to UK. The Wildcat season is over, but ended on a high note with a win over Tennessee last Saturday after, 26 years of straight defeats. So that kind of leaves a good taste in the fans' mouth for next year.
Well, it was very important. It was bigger than any bowl win Kentucky could have gotten, and bigger really maybe than any bowl win they've had in the last 3 or 4 years. I think they played really well the last two games, and that was the big thing that fans, I think, needed to see from Joker Phillips. A lot of them are still disenchanted. But at least the program showed some fight, showed signs of life, showed that it hadn't given up. And I think that'll enable them to get through this offseason and come back next year and have some at least momentum.
Not bowl eligible, but Joker Phillips will be back next season.
I believe so, unless there's a big change. I believe he's back and going to get at least one more year.
We're talking about the success of the University of Louisville. Howard Snellenberger, who hasn't been with the program for a while, but is Florida Atlantic, is retiring after this season. I think his final game is this weekend, right?
That's right. And just, he's a Hall of Fame kind of guy and really there's been no better builder of programs in the history of college football than Howard Snellenberger. And not only that, but he's the last, I think, we see with Joe Paterno out at Penn State and Bobby Bowden having quit and a lot of these old guard, I think he's the last of the really old guard coaches, the Bear Bryant disciples, mm-hmm. The gruff old men of the game. And, He was great for Louisville, obviously, and has been great for college football, and he'll be missed.
Really took U of L to new heights. I've heard the story told numerous times that before Howard came along, you could go to a convenience store and buy an Icy and get free U of L football tickets,
Well, in some years, while he was here, you could do that. But it certainly, Louisville football was in danger of being dropped. It was just not cost-effective, and he saved it from that. Bill Olson brought him here, and together the two saved it from that, and here it is today.
And turning to basketball quickly, UofL versus Vandy tonight, big game for the Cards. They've been kind of plagued with injuries here in the early going.
It's been really freakish, and they are so far untested by a team of the level of Vanderbilt coming in. It'll be interesting to see how this kind of remnant of players that Rick Pitino is using, with so many guys injured and hurt, will do against a team of this caliber. And really, it's going to kind of give us a sign of what to expect over the next month or so.
And tomorrow night in Lexington, UK versus North Carolina. UK ranked first in the country as of this week. Is that a deserved ranking, you think?
I think it is. And this is one of the games of the year now in college basketball. Before the NBA lockout was settled, there were probably going to be more NBA players on the floor for this game than in any game we saw all year. So these are generally perceived to be the two most talented teams in the country, and it's a huge game, biggest game we've seen in this state in a long time.
You have a pick for that one?
I think Kentucky wins. I don't see anybody beating them on their home floor, so I think they're going to be hard to stop.
And Tom Crean appears to have IU back on track.
Yeah, IU's doing well. He just had a huge win at NC State. I believe they've started out 7-0, and that's the first time that's happened in forever. So that's an exciting story locally. I'd be remiss if we didn't mention Western Kentucky football, which is bowl eligible. And actually, in kind of a bittersweet thing, while Louisville's rooting for Cincinnati to lose, I think Western needs Cincinnati to win to get to a bowl because they're not locked into any bowls. So they're still sweating it out, but they're eligible, and that's a remarkable story in Bowling Green.
Don't want to leave out the Hilltoppers. All right, Eric Crawford, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
Eric Crawford with the Courier-Journal. We are out of time. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. For more information about today's program or to hear it again, visit WFPL.org. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.